Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the June 23rd edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author. He's the host of the Capital Record podcast and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. It is so weird that we are in the same city, but not in the same room.
That's right. And the same city is Grand Rapids, Michigan, where we're both attending, thanks to your introduction, the Acton Institute's Acton University, the Summer Smash Talk Fest, and well, more like a Think Fest. It's just been absolutely amazing. And I got to tell you, your presentation yesterday, which was linked to the publication of There's No Free Lunch, was a wonderful, wide-ranging conversation about your personal faith and the connection to economics. And I've heard just, I mean, people have voluntarily brought this up, not knowing of our connection at all. And just a really great job, buddy.
I appreciate it very much. I enjoyed the talk a great deal. I got great feedback on both of my talks yesterday. But even more important than the feedback and when people say encouraging things, I mean, it's always nice to be flattered and complimented. There is you're right. It's a talk fest. It's a think fest. But it also really is. And I don't say this very much. I'm not one of these touchy feely types, as you know. It's great fellowship. These are our people.
Yeah.
If we got to go to war, this is who I'm going to war with. These people that care about the hearts and minds of men. I just feel at home with this group, this cause, and it's so fun to have you out here, brother.
It is that. You look around the room, and there are people from all over the world, huge contingent from Brazil this year. Evangelicals, small sects that I haven't heard about since I was a graduate student studying the 19th century. S-E-C-T-S.
Oh, my gosh. I was going to say, you're in a different session than I am.
No wonder pants were optional. No. So I sat yesterday with a Catholic couple. This is primarily it's dominated by Catholicism, of course, because it's Father Sirico who leads this amazing effort.
By the way, though, actually, I want to correct you. It isn't dominated. It's a 50-50.
Thank you.
It's 50-50. Yeah. It's very ecumenical.
Inspired by, Father Sirico's Catholicism. But, you know, I met people who are evangelicals, Protestants of all varieties, Jews, Orthodox, Russians, Ukrainians, Greeks. Yeah. It is a place where people agree on one thing, that free markets and liberty are the way to produce human flourishing. There's something, I saw a slogan of the Acton Institute yesterday for the first time that I had not seen before. It says, connecting good intentions with sound economics. And I thought that is the best way to put it, because the people here in their endeavor to help the poor, the marginalized, and just every human on the planet is something that we share in common with our best intention friends on the left. We just believe they've got the prescription. They've got the they've diagnosed a problem. Hey, there's immense poverty or challenges in learning or whatever it may be. But we believe the prescription is more liberty, not less. Yeah. Less government, not more. And you look around this room, there's got to be, 1,200 people here this week?
Yeah, it's over 1,000, biggest they've ever had.
Yeah, it is so impressive. And your friend Amity Schles, whose talks and books I cannot recommend. Can you just, for those who don't have the pleasure of knowing her, can you give a quick overview? And then I promise we'll get to California news.
Amity was a longtime writer at the Wall Street Journal and had out of Chicago, and then wrote a book called The Forgotten Man in, I believe, 2007 or 8. It became a big seller in 2009. And it was really a sort of seminal work on what had happened in the Great Depression and correcting a narrative intellectually, historically, narratively. She's a great storyteller. She uses the characters of the actual history to tell the stories, really a deeper dive into FDR's cabinet and his advisors than you will ever read anywhere. and allows readers to extract some of the conclusions. She doesn't write by pointing on the board what it all means. She allows the story to tell itself, but essentially correcting the awful, awful historical record of the Great Depression that suggests that the New Deal is what ended it. And tells the story of what the damage that was really done by sort of resetting the expectation for federal government and a lot of the cronyism that took place, a lot of the misallocation of capital out of these huge infrastructure projects and New Deal expenditures. So that's really what put her on her map as an economic historian. She then took on a project. I became very close with her, and I helped finance an illustrated animated version of Forgotten Man. And it became one of the best sellers of all that genre of books. It came out about, I think, 2012. And it got great readership. A lot of high school students and younger people were able to read it. It was really kind of fun. But then she started a multi-year project becoming the really serious biographer of Calvin Coolidge. She ended up writing a 650-page magnum opus about Coolidge. And from there became the president of the Calvin Coolidge Foundation and has done incredible work there, has since written a book on the Great Society, telling the story of LBJ and the great expansion of government poverty programs in the 1960s. So she's an economic historian. She's married to Seth Lipsky, who is the editor and owner of the New York Sun and a longtime economic writer and kind of a libertarian sound money guy. She's as sweet as can be. She's brilliant. She's feisty. She's just a lovely person, and I'm very blessed to have her as a friend.
She was one of the featured speakers two nights ago. You and I are sitting on opposite sides of this vast ballroom at the DeVos Center.
And before people get the impression that it's because I'm up front at the head table and you're in the back, which was true that night, but you have been invited to some VIP tables several occasions. And I consider it one of the most fun experiences I have to have you sitting with me when we're with Father Sirico or Chris Marin or some of the head people. These are lovely conversations, are they not?
They are. And to find out that Father Sirico and I have traveled a parallel path, when I first met him a couple of years ago, he said something like, you introduced me as a former communist. And he said, well, you're a Catholic.
I think I said Marxist.
Marxist. Like, thank you. Yeah, yeah. That's right. Thank you. And he said, well, you're a Catholic. Who wasn't at some point? It was very funny. So back to Amity for one moment. Her conversation the other night, it was a story about the connection between Walter Reuther, who was head of the United Auto Workers, from its very origins, just a seminal landmark figure in American 20th century history, and his connection to LBJ and the Great Society. And then this fascinating little anecdote about the Port Huron Statement, which, of course, Port Huron is here in Michigan. Port Huron is the location of the UAW summer camp, this massive facility she described as Reuther's kind of, what would you call it, monument to Scandinavian socialism.
Yeah.
And it was Reuther who invited Tom Hayden and what would become the members of the Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s. See, they came out here in 62. They sit down at this UAW summer camp in the summer at this time of the year, in fact, in June of 62. So, oh my gosh, that's 60 years ago this month. I guess this becomes our history bit. Tom Hayden, our listeners may already know, was just then a student at the University of Michigan who writes the Port Huron Statement, which some folks on the left think is like the most important American left-wing manifesto ever written. And it is a break with the old left in America, which had been, or the old workers' movement, which had always been anti-communist, pro-America, pro-democracy, mostly for free markets, not socialist. But Reuther, of course, had taken the UAW way down the socialist path. So he's delighted to have young Tom Hayden there. And Hayden goes on, the Port Huron Statement really sets off SDS, the Students for Democratic Society. Hayden, of course, ends up in California, where he marries an actress, Jane Fonda, and then runs for state government. And well, he runs for mayor of LA. He runs for a bunch of stuff, but he runs for and wins an assembly seat out of Santa Monica and then becomes a state senator. He's in office for, I want to say 18 years or so, from like 1980 forward to the late 90s. And in that time is the author of just really leftist kinds of bills and is a leader in the Senate pushing this stuff. And among other things,
I would add, I think, a likable guy.
Tom Hayden's a wonderful guy. A small footnote. I babysat for the Fondas two times while I was an undergrad in Santa Monica, once sneaking out a copy of, oh my gosh, Barbarella with Jane Fonda. Did you ever see the movie? It's a kind of a sci-fi French inspired film in space in which Jane Fonda, scantily clad, is floating gravity free through a spaceship at one point. So my friend and I find this. This is the days pre-video. My friend and I, who are babysitting for the Fondas, he's her their security team. He and I are watching this thing and on film. Right. Like on a wall in their house in Santa Monica, we're watching this and it's late at night. The kids are in bed. The lights are low. And we're just watching this movie going like, oh, my gosh, that's the woman. And she and Tom walk in early to see us watching Jane scantily clad on the white wall of their immense home in Santa Monica. And they were both really appealing people. I got to say, I'm not here to, you know, to talk a lot about her politics or that sort of thing, but they were very nice people. Yeah. And they were under constant threat for reasons you can understand, the frustration and the outrage about what she did during the Vietnam War, visiting North Vietnam and POW.
And it being on video, being in television the way it was. Like there was a sort of media encapsulation. Like I suspect, actually, we know that Hollywood had always had people that were unsupportive of American effort. There was a significant communist infiltration of Hollywood post World War II, but there wasn't the television imagery of it. And Fonda walking around in North Vietnam was just brutal.
Yeah.
On national television, you know.
Wasn't she sitting at one point like on an anti-aircraft gun, the sort of thing that North Vietnamese used to shoot down American pilots? And again, whatever one thinks of the Vietnam War, it's a complicated story. But there she was visiting the enemy, you know, the people who were shooting at Americans and killing them at a rate of, you know, what, 58,000 by the time the war's over. And to your point, you know, the infiltration of Hollywood by the left, Haskell Wexler, the filmmaker, went with them out there and documented the whole thing. And the blowback lasted for decades. You know, wherever the Fondas showed up, they really did need a security team. You know, people checking for bombs under their car, watching the kids all the time. That's why I was babysitting with a security guy. So, it's just an absolutely fascinating story. And Hayden's record in the state legislature is on a par with the kind of lunacy we see today. He, you know, of course, it was absent the whole gender issue, which has become so weird. And the critical race theory was only then really just in its origins in the 80s and 90s when he's in office. But he wasn't that guy. He was, by contrast, a new old left. He was part of the new left. And he was anti-communist, he said. That is to say, he was opposed to people who were anti-communist. And part of the big break with the old left, inspired by Wexler, was that maybe being anti-communist wasn't such a terrible thing. Walter Reuther's fascination with socialist experiments, especially in Europe, he was not a Stalinist. But Reuther's play with Tom Hayden and Tom Hayden's role in California government is something that some of us ought to take a deeper look at. Great dissertation subject, could be a fun biography, just to look at that intersection of celebrity and war and politics
and culture.
California. Yes, 100%.
You know, I tease you sometimes about some of the historical things with California, and I think there's varying degrees of some that have been more interesting than others, you know, for me.
You're so kind. That's high praise.
But I will say, like, when Amity was talking the other night, and we're in Michigan, which is why they asked her to come talk about the impact of UAW, particularly on Ford. It had more of a Ford historical theme than even GM. But this is a state that, like, you can't find anyone who's lived here that doesn't care about and know about the history of what they did to the automotive industry and what impact it had on the statewide economy. And I think some of those stories, as they apply to California, I think they are very interesting. And there is a crux of history in that 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a bridge from which California went from the golden state to this insane state. And those are the moments that pivoted. And there is a arc of historical and cultural and economic activity that I think is very interesting. And when I hear Amity tell the story, she really didn't give a little bit, but she didn't give much of a speech about here's why unions are bad. Here's the economics of what went wrong in collective bargaining. Here's the economics of the pension expense and how it stripped out margin from automobiles. She talked about their total flat-footedness in competition with Japan. That's another story that I think unions deserve blame for. It's very difficult when you're spending all your time negotiating fat retirement packages to compete with the Toyota Corolla, you know, and so essentially this story of what happened in the U.S. auto industry that Amity told so well through the lens of this man's life, which, by the way, I did not know how his life ended.
Remind me. I'm so sorry. I was probably writing notes.
He died in an airplane crash.
That's right.
With his wife going to his dream campsite up there at
Port Huron,
which I think is a Bass Lake. Black Lake.
There you go. Yeah.
And he was on his way to a kind of big retreat thing there and died in an airplane crash in 1970 or 72. And the way Amity concluded was that it was a tragic ending to life, and we all would recognize this awful, you know, early death. I think he was in his 60s or something. But also that he didn't live to see the tragedy that would become of his work of the U.S. automotive industry. He never saw what he basically browbeat out of Ford and GM killed those companies.
Yes. And isn't it fascinating that, you know, the popular, again, just as with the Depression and Amity's revisionist history of the Depression and FDR's role in actually extending, expanding the catastrophe, the common myth that a lot of us grow up with, and Amity kept touching on the song, Which Side Are You On? The classic union song. And even growing up in the 70s, as I did, when the UAW was still a prominent feature in which most people were, and Ruther was already dead by the time I'm learning about this stuff, but I'm learning a completely made up story about how free market capitalism destroyed Detroit, that we just failed to understand that the implications of free trade and the Japanese exploited the American market and that business people let it happen. The fact is that she tells a very different story of how unions, through coercion and money and cultural tools like Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda, were able to create this myth of union strength, creating great jobs. She points out something that I love to point out, and you and I've talked about, and that is that on the left, there's this notion that somehow post-World War II prosperity in America is owing to unions. And we hear this constantly out of Sacramento about our own unions, that union jobs should be paid, but they're paid better as a way to lift all boats. But in fact, they cost somebody something somewhere. And here it was business competitiveness. And in California, this is why we are watching businesses leave. They simply can no longer afford to stay open. They either just simply collapse, they capitulate for a time to unionization. We've talked about Lorena Gonzalez, the assemblywoman out of San Diego, and her efforts to create sectoral bargaining in the fast food industry in California. That means that the government now represents all labor in the fast food industry. We know from Michigan, we know from history where this leads, and it leads to a fireball and the destruction of an entire state. Michigan is only now really starting to claw back, but the left is still powerful here, and the union movement is still wonderfully has the wind at its back with this myth of how great union jobs are.
So we talk so much about, and your big focus and the really effective work that CPC does is in the sector of, in the world of public employee unions. I'd like to see somebody like Amity, who has such an incredible knowledge of the history of private labor unions and what the UAW, which is one of the most nefarious, but we can look at the airline industry as well. We can look at the AFL-CIO and SEIU, and you can tell a similar story of where there's been a real degradation of American competitiveness and innovation, and economic modeling that has been destructive and wealth destructive. I would like to see someone bridge those things to the public employee unions, because the big difference to me is the private labor unions, as best I can tell historically, started with good intent and became both abusive, corrupt, and unnecessary, right? Like, there were not unsafe working conditions in 1972 at a regular Ford plant. There was a different environment than what the labor unions were fighting against in the early part of 20th century. What I would argue that on the public employee union side, there's the awful economics, there's corruption, there's power, and yet also a total lack of clarity as to why the hell they ever existed to begin with. I know what the itch was that the private employee unions were attempting to scratch 100 years ago. I do not know what itch the public sector unions were supposed to ever scratch. And I believe that the case can be made that there's an entirely different category of corruption in the public employee unions.
Yes, there is, because they actually control the government outright. The private sector unions were major players, of course, in politics, but they didn't work for the government. They weren't inside. And I am
so
now.
So another, it'd be like what people say, like the right will say George Soros does, or the left will say that the Koch brothers do. That they were, the private sector unions had a heavy influence because they had money and they had and numbers, but they were just fighting as lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying the public employee unions are on the inside.
Yes. Yeah. The distinction here is that when Walter Reuther sits down to negotiate contracts with Ford or GM or whomever, he's sitting across the table from someone who, for better or for worse, represents something like the bottom line of the corporation. There is no similar relationship where public sector unions are operating in California. When a government union leader goes in to negotiate a contract at the local or state level in California, he or she is sitting across the table from somebody they helped elect. Yeah. Or who ultimately will report to all the people the union helped elect. So it's just totally a kind of, it is cronyism. We buy the candidates first so that when they're in office, they turn around and rubber stamp our contracts and give us basically what we want. There is no limiting principle. There's nobody there looking out for the taxpayer, or very rarely in California. So that that legal corruption at the heart of that political engagement is not present in the private sector union space.
Yeah.
All right. Let's start with a couple of quick letters. We got one from Pete Beyer, a listener who says, love the podcast, even though I'm languishing in New Jersey. Hello, Pete. I heard David lamenting that he usually can't watch a full playoff game, and you doing the same about college baseball. You both have the resources to get a DVR. A DVR, and have children who could probably teach you to work it. I watch most of my sports that way. The only downside is that sometimes you already know the outcome.
So let me help him out a little bit here.
Please.
I think he may have missed the point. The DVR enables you to watch something later, but if the problem is you do not have time, it is not later. That you don't have time to watch it live. I do not have time to watch it live or later.
Right.
So until they make a DVR that comes with 2 extra hours in the day, we haven't satisfied the tension. But I do appreciate the exhortation of my young people teach me how to use a DVR. But I will actually bring him up to the year 2022. They would not be teaching me how to use a DVR either. They would be teaching me how to use one of the 46 streaming services that we use on their cell phones. We're very close to a point where these kids are not going to know anything about television or cable or DVR or networks at all.
Yeah, the common refrain among my children as they were growing up was, oh my God, if you turned on some great classic movie, I don't know, Gone with the Wind or something, they would go, oh my gosh, how horrible a black and white movie. They are color in the case of Gone with the Wind, but You get the picture. Hey, something more serious from Brian Walters. Last week, I mentioned regarding Scott Wiener and his constant weird affection for bills that I think divide families, that is parents against kids. Just as we have class warfare on the left, we also have kind of let's destroy the family, parents v. children. And Scott Wiener has, among other things, for example, we talked about this last week, lowered the vaccination consent age to 12. That's his bill. I mentioned that Senate Bill 145 in 2020, which Gavin Newsom signed, I said that that bill actually lowers the age of consent for gay and lesbian kids engaged in sex acts with older people. Yeah. I just want to be, and you questioned whether it was accurate. It is. The fact is that what this bill does precisely, Brian Walters reminds me, he's the guy who originally emailed in and told me, hey, look, there's an important nuance here. And the nuance is that, yes, the age of consent for sex with a minor now is a 10-year gap. That is that you cannot have more than a 10-year gap with a child who is 14. That would make an adult 24. And a judge can use his or her discretion to determine whether that constitutes statutory rape. So my argument and Brian's point is that that's already that sort of judicial discretion is already allowed a judge in cases where the act is, let's call it heterosexual sex, just so we don't get too fine a point. There may be sensitive listeners.
You don't have to use the V word.
Thank you. So
and by the way, you should tell listeners, this conversation apparently you had with Brian was sounds like the conversation you and I had by either email or text.
Yes.
But where I concluded was we can't clarify it on air without having to talk about things I refuse to talk about.
Yeah. So I'll just make it really simple. Yes. This brings into alignment judicial discretion in all cases of what we used to call statutory rape.
Biologically, there is more, he was going for a consistency in the way heterosexual stuff was treated, which was a little different than the way we presented it last week.
I presented it. You actually raised the question. So I went back and I read the stories. Yes.
We're in this together. So,
okay. Well, you're a kind, you're a friend. Yeah. Nevertheless, my sense remains, my perspective remains that a law which expands the or drops the age at which a child can be considered to have legitimate authority over his or her own body in a sexual relationship with an older person, a person over 18, is just weird to begin with. And I'm troubled by that. I'm troubled. I get it when it's a 17-year-old and an 18 or 19 or 20-year-old even and a 17-year-old. I get the judicial discretion.
Yeah.
But you're carving parents out beginning at the age of 14. And assuming that a 14-year-old now has the,
And again, it was still defaulting to judge's discretion. So if that was happening, it wouldn't have been the law doing it. It would have been the judge. But I think what my comment to you was, I'd like to repeat my fundamental problem. I do have less of a problem with what I found out he was doing versus what I first understood it to be. I do have less of a problem with it yet. I don't understand this being on anyone's radar at all. Now, if he came and said, hey, we have 34 people that are currently imprisoned for something, and he was 19 and the other guy was 17, and because of the nature of the physicality, the judge ruled it this, where if it was heterosexual, he may not have had to rule this way. If there was some case of correcting a prosecutorial injustice or inconsistency, but that isn't my understanding either. It's like this seems to me to have been done for no other reason than to virtue signal and sort of get attention for something that I just can't even comprehend would be on his radar. I do think that the weightier matters of the law, to use the biblical text, you got better things to do, dog.
Where's my pen? There's our there's the title of the episode. I don't have a piece of paper. There were many more letters, but in the interest of time, let's just move more quickly. We've got Kamala news here, David. Here's
no
the
way.
Headline. Yes. Many of our listeners will already have seen this story, but it's just sort of fun. There's the Democratic National Committee is hosting an event, a fundraiser with Kamala Harris next week. And I'll tell you the truth. It says in California. And I read, I don't know, 12 stories yesterday. And I looked all over the internet trying to find out where in the great state of California this fundraiser takes place. It doesn't say. They refer to it as in Cali, in California. But they don't even give us like regional, you know, like in Northern California. California or Southern or something like that. So I don't know where this event takes place next week. It's the DNC's Women's Leadership Forum. And here's the story. The DNC slashing the price of Kamala Harris's photo op sparks mockery on Twitter that this is the one thing immune to inflation. So here's the story. The DNC had offered photo ops with attendees at the event for $15,000. Get your picture taken with Kamala Harris. But it failed to sell enough tickets and so is being postponed. Now they are charging $5,000 for a photo. And the joke, of course, is at a time of record high inflation from the story. At a time of record high inflation with prices soaring across the board, critics had fun with the notion that the only thing that has gotten cheaper during this economic crisis is a photo op with the VP. And I think it's fascinating that the new price set at $5,000 is roughly 30% of the original price, right? 33%. And that's about where her poll numbers are. So, you know, there's the market sort of reflecting poll popularity, I guess, in some weird little way. Let me find our next story. I'm doing this now, David, without any kind of paper here. So I'm old school. So I'm doing this live on the computer.
You mean you're actually having to look at articles on a screen and links and PDFs and stuff? That's brutal. I don't know how you do it.
It means that I can't look into the windows of your soul because I'm over here looking at the screen. This is a story next about Gavin Newsom, similar sort of like, and I know it's nut picking, but you know, it's just fun to start out with a little bit of an hors d'oeuvre here before we dive into the bigger stuff. Gavin Newsom announced this week that he was going to start trolling on Truth Social. This is, of course, the Trump-backed, Devin Newsom-run social media, sort of Twitter-like platform that is supposed to be very much like Twitter, and it's supposed to be a total free speech space. And Newsom says he has just joined Trump's Truth Social. Here's his tweet. He goes onto Twitter to tell us what he's doing over on Truth Social. And this sort of fits with your line about Scott Wiener here. He says, going to be on there calling out Republican lies. This could get ellipsis interesting. My first post, breaking down America's red state murder problem on Truth Social.
I hope he fired the staffer that wrote that. Like, what are they doing?
Yes. Again,
you said, no way do you think Gavin even knew about it? Like, that is just so dumb.
It really does seem dumb and designed to fetch the eyeballs of people who already like him. And if you go in and you look at I'll put a link to the tweet in the show notes, but you can see that it attracts the usual crowd of people who are just delighted to see some, you know, our governor spending his time. And again, it's probably a staffer trolling the Republican lies. And it's clearly aimed, as critics see, I think rightly, that this is aimed at generating a broader national audience, that this is the guy who will stand up to Donald Trump should Trump run for office or, you know, any Republican anywhere. And to the point of his story, the governor is claiming that red states have a murder problem that California does not and that blue states do not. Which is instantly shredded on its face. There are all kinds of stats out there that show you that cities like L.A. and San Francisco, Oakland, Stockton, California cities have a murder problem. And it's not white supremacy. It's typically occurring in really tough neighborhoods where poor people attack other poor people. And the attempt to sort of label this a red state problem is equally bizarre. It is as bizarre as our governor spending his precious time trolling Trump.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a really fascinating story here. California bill requiring CalPERS and CalSTRS to divest. Halted by committee chair. David, this is one of those great stories. And I just want to say that, you know, it's such a delight every once in a while to see California government do something sensible. The move here was activists, environmental activists in California and their allies trying to get the two massive public employee pensions, CalPERS, that's California Public Employee Retirement System, and CalSTRS, that's the same pension system for teachers, or a similar one for teachers. And they wanted these guys to divest. Now, CalPERS alone has $500 billion in investable assets. And I will leave it to you to explain why that's significant. But it seems to me,
has it gotten up to 500?
It's 456 at last count. And, you know, the stock market hasn't been what it was when I read this 2 weeks ago, you know, about where they were. But, you know, this story came out this week, just a day or two ago. You and I are recording on Thursday morning. Sorry for the lateness, my friends. But earlier this week, it was that this bill that was moving through the State House would have required these massive pension funds to divest themselves of any sort of fossil fuel, climate damaging investments. So here's the lead from the story. And this is from a, I don't know if you know this publication, David, it's called Pensions and Investments. So I don't know about its reliability.
But it is reliable. It's a good publication. I've actually been quoted in it several times.
Great. Well, that establishes its bona fides for me. Two California divestment bills, one that would have required CalPERS and CalSTRS to divest from fossil fuels and another to divest from companies with business operations in Russia or Belarus, are dead for this session after an assembly committee chairman declined to schedule the bills for hearings. The assemblyman is Jim Cooper. He's chairman of the Assembly Public Employment and Retirement Committee, and he decided to hold both bills, which were expected to be heard this week, because he opposes any measure that would require, oh, here they say $433 billion CalPERS and $314 billion for CalSTRS to divest from a particular entity or industry. He says, Cooper does, previous legislative divestment requirements have resulted in long-term negative financial effects on California's pension system. David, you're the expert. Talk to me.
We've talked about this a lot. This is rhetoric and an intention that these wokey wokes, non-fiduciaries have had for quite some time that they got away with. It had a certain appeal because it not only met the kind of Marxian ideology of their peeps, but it was coincident with a period where fossil investments were performing poorly. And so right now, you mentioned the market has struggled here on the year. You have a lot of tech-oriented stuff that's down 30, 40, 50%, some super-duper cool tech stuff that's down 70, 80, 90%. And you have the only positive performing sector in the market on the year is energy. And the top performing sector in the market all of last year was energy. So you're in a very structural and secular bull market in fossil, and there is a bear market playing out, a real correction and repricing in many of the other areas. And these poor pensioners are being denied those returns and denied that attribution of positive performance. And they're being denied it because the person who is tasked with a legal fiduciary duty to look out for them is acting like an ideologue and a zealot and ignoramus. And so I believe that watching CalPERS in particular, this is true of a lot of these institutional investors, and particularly those that run pension funds for public employee groups, they are, I've said this many times, this is not the A team of institutional investment management. But watching them is like a lagging indicator of the clown show. You recall when they said, well, what we're going to do is get out of public markets. And the stock market ended up going on to have two of its best years in history. And they said, we want to dive more into private equity and put some leverage on it. And you thought, yeah, that sounds like a really good idea. Lever up an illiquid asset, you know, right near the end of an economic cycle. So they just are notorious for doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. And in this particular case, it's everybody in investment management. This includes me as well. And I'm obviously very proud of the work me and my firm do. But everybody will make mistakes. Everyone will get a call wrong. That's not what their problem is here. They're not making an investment call. They're saying, despite an investment call, we want to screw over the people that we are responsible to because of a religious dogma. And it's not going to end well. I'm telling you right now, it will not end well. And there will end up being significant lawsuits because I think we'll be in an extended period where their horse crap will underperform and the important stuff will perform well, and they will be exposed inversely to such.
It wasn't a total victory because he's just, you know, holding the bill, which means, you know, let's watch, you know, the old Chekhov Anton, not the guy in Star Trek, line that if there's a gun in the first act, it'll be fired in the third.
But thanks for that clarification, because I was super confused.
I'm sure you were. He is a big Star Trek fan. But, you know, CalPERS and CalSTRS are full of people who consider it their duty to make political rather than financial calls. Yeah. And I guess I would be absolutely enthusiastic if, you know, we were maybe trying to marginalize the use of slave labor in Chinese Uyghur camps or something. But this thing is not dead. Even the CalSTRS, the Teachers Pension Fund spokeswoman, said in an email to PNI, she said, climate change is about more than fossil fuel companies. Our entire investment portfolio is affected by climate risk. And CalSTRS uses a more holistic approach, she said, including measuring emissions, engaging directly with companies, working to expand government policies, and investing in solutions. This is down at the very bottom of the story. And it's fascinating because it reveals the political nature of how these pension funds operate, that, you know, they consider it their mission to do things like measure emissions and engage directly with companies to expand government policies and invest in solutions, the solutions they pick. And you and I have talked about this almost ad nauseum at this point, but these are entities that are supposed to secure the retirement programs of people who have worked in the state of California, the government unions that I so frequently malign. But in fact, they use their cash as a plaything, much the way that Walter Reuther used the pension funds. We didn't talk about this part of Reuther's campaign, but the pension funds at UAW were just absolutely looted by the pension fund owners. So that workers at many auto factories lost their pensions. So same thing here. We've got, you know, and we talked a couple of weeks ago, John Myers, the great Sacramento bureau chief for the LA Times, announced that he was leaving the Times to go to work for CalPERS, where he said that his two things would be securing the future of California's public employee retirees and also using the mighty influence of CalPERS to influence politics, especially along climate change and social justice. So it's this just really, I think those two things are often at odds and not just in creative tension. And, you know, the sooner government employees recognize that their funds are being used to play politics, I think, the better off we all are. And there's hope, I guess. That's the point of that story. Meanwhile, gas prices going nuts. Here's a story from, where did I find this one? In the Mercury News. California lawmakers promise a probe into gas price gouging. David, this is something that happens every time there is a hike in the price of gas, that our lawmakers do two things. They ignore what's really at work in gasoline and energy pricing in order to say that something evil is afoot. So here's a Democratic state lawmaker. We've got Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon, who's from L.A. I think he's from L.A., saying the oil industry has, quote, a foot on our necks and a hand in our pockets. These are companies that are obviously ripping off California consumers, and we need to ask tough questions about them and their business practices. California's gas prices are about a dollar or a little more higher than the national average, about $1.50. And at no point does Rendon do all these other guys spouting off about class warfare in the oil industry and how the oil industry is screwing us over. None of them cite the fact that California's own regulations are problematic and add to that. So we've got state taxes that are about a buck higher than any other state in the nation. And we've got a gas price disparity, a delta of about a buck. What might be at work there? Well, at the same time, the state of California announces that it will proceed with a hike in the state gas tax. We've got a few state legislators who are pointing out that, you know, with gas prices rising, isn't this time for a gas tax holiday? And in fact, at the federal level, you've got Joe Biden making the same claim that we ought to drop the gas tax just temporarily. And Biden's calling it a tax holiday. But out here, Newsom says this is an outrage. Gas taxes have nothing to do with the high price of gasoline. A great piece by Jim Garrity in the Morning Jolt from National Review. He says, this morning, the national average price for a gallon of regular gasoline has dropped a few pennies from the all-time high on June 14th. On that date, it was $5.01. This morning, it's $4.98. In California, the statewide average is $6.39. That's almost about $1.50 higher. So he says, Jim does, naturally, at the end of the month, the state government of California will increase the state tax on gasoline from 51 to 54 cents a gallon. And he notes, and thank God for Garrity, he notes this key, that the environmental regulations that make gasoline more expensive in California. California's reformulated gas program is more stringent than that of the federal government. California gasoline must use a different formula in warmer weather in an effort to curb pollution. As a result, gas prices in the state are typically higher and more variable because few supply sources outside the state are able to offer California's boutique blend of gasoline. So we've got government factors driving up the cost of gasoline, and then the government turning around and saying, got to be the oil companies are ripping us off. And it's just one of those, I don't know, I'm almost inconsolable with the irony. I don't know whether to laugh or to cry all the time with this sort of thing. I think all we can do is really laugh. Crying doesn't help.
I agree. Laughing is more therapeutic.
Yeah. So any thoughts there, David, or is this just the simple, there's no free lunch? You don't get to raise taxes and get all this revenue without somebody else paying the price. And that somebody is the California automobile driver.
Yeah, but it's not just the taxes. It's the other thing you said, too, is the regulation. Mm-hmm. It's the invisible effects of keeping production from happening, including within our own state. It's their stated ideological goal to put these companies out of business. They can't make money if we don't let them produce. Then by not letting them produce, what they've done is push prices higher when we desperately need their product. So there's an incoherent policy from the Biden administration, but in this particular case, from the state of California. And this notion is rich, that there's price gouging going on. It was a minute ago that these companies were losing $20 billion in the calendar year of 2020. Okay, I blinked, and now we're talking about price gouging. Dear God, what is wrong with these people? I mean, how shameful do you have to be to say this? All global demand evaporates into thin air as they shut the world down and bring airline traffic to its knees, take people out of cars, take people out of activity, out of social interaction. And these energy companies, and meanwhile, our dear friends, Saudi and Russia, flood the world with oil. You end up with such excess inventory that at some of futures expirations, they can't even find people to do takeaway. And what got quoted as a negative oil price was really that they were having to pay people to come take the oil to go store it. And now all of a sudden, the supply and demand fundamentals are different and they're accused of price gouging. I would rather you just say thank you and go on your way.
Well, you ask, what were they thinking? I don't think they were thinking. I already talked about Scott Wiener, and I probably should have put this story in the show notes a little higher up when we were talking about the senator from the Bay Area. But while Rome is burning, Scott Wiener has a bill to decriminalize loitering for prostitution. That bill is now on the governor's desk. The big question is, will he sign it? It's Senate Bill 357, which passed out of the legislature last September, despite objections from law enforcement and human trafficking support groups. That is, you know, people who don't support human traffickers, they oppose it, as well as a few Democratic moderates. But the bill is back, and here's the former LAPD sergeant, now with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. She says this bill severely cripples law enforcement's ability to arrest and prosecute human traffickers and sex buyers. If it's repealed, sex buyers would have immunity. Sex buyers, I think, are what we used to call Johns in the parlance. But Wiener says that the loitering law is generally used by police to harass and discriminate against Black and brown people, as well as LGBTQ people, particularly those in the transgender community. And Wiener made his, as the bill goes to Newsom for signing, Wiener says this is Pride Month. And as we see a surge in violence against and harassment of the LGBTQ community, it's more important than ever to get rid of a law that targets our community. Current law essentially allows law enforcement to target and arrest people if they're wearing tight clothes or a lot of makeup. Many of those affected by this law are Black and brown trans women. Pride isn't just about rainbow flags and parades. It's about protecting the most marginalized in our community. I urge Governor Newsom to sign the bill.
And with the implication, I may have misunderstood Pride Month. I thought Pride Month was a special time of really extra super duper celebration of various people's sexual orientation. But it sounds like at the end of Pride Month, he's saying we get to go back to targeting them with violence, which I did not know that. So we only have a 1 month break from our norm of physical aggression against people that are different than us sexually. 11 months of the year, we're still allowed to just go. Okay. So, yeah, I guess you're going to need a law to stop that. They should pass a law against violence.
That would be great, wouldn't it? You know, force and fraud. These would be, what a terrific idea, David. Just a simple.
But I think this comes back to the same thing from before. Like, by the way, nobody who listens to this podcast, let alone the two people who host it, want to see Black or brown trans people targeted violently or any of this stuff. Mm-mm. Nobody wants it. I want them to get help is what I want. I want them to be, you know what I'm saying? Like I have compassion and hope for a whole lot of things I won't get into here, but here's the point I want to make. This guy doesn't believe this.
No.
It's just this posturing and this grandstanding. It's pharisaical. I'm getting kind of sick of it. Like, I have a feeling I'm going to be getting to a point where I ask you to quit talking about Scott Wiener, because this guy is a douche. I'm tired of it.
He is that indeed. I could go on, but I think, you know, the point is that, you know, as the state burns, we've got a governor playing around on Truth Social, or at least saying that he is. We've got the oil industry being accused of things that are clearly fantastical. And we've got Scott Wiener worrying about a community that is already protected by laws against assault and other kinds of violence.
So I'd like to bring these two stories together.
Please.
Is it possible we could increase fossil production and get more deregulation in oil and gas and lower prices and lower tax pressures and increased drilling and a more fertile environment for the industry if these companies would populate their C-suites with LGBTQ executives? Like at least during Pride Month, what would you do there? Because I would say that anything that is seeking to deny them business growth would be a grotesque attack on their sexual identity.
Yes, I like your thinking that liberty for trans people would be furthered by a lower cost of living for everybody.
Yeah,
I think that's what you're saying.
I'm going to think about this.
Please. And then we'll run you for governor on that platform or plank. Hey, let's skip down the run list a little bit in the interest of time and talk about the rise again of COVID, David. I've got this headline.
Oh, my God, you better be joking.
Well, here's the fascinating contradiction. You've got here's a story from the LA Times. Headline reads, "This new California coronavirus wave isn't sticking to the script. Big spread, less illness." Now, this is sort of what people
have. It is the script.
Yes, that's
it's been the script forever.
Yes.
It's been a script since 3 months after COVID started. What are they talking about?
Well, yes. But the LA Times has been a latecomer to this. No,
but what are they seriously talking about? What are they saying?
You have to believe the idea that COVID, we don't need to dig in. You could write a book on this subject. But the fact is, you're right. Within 3 months, we already knew the trajectory of this illness, that immunity and vaccines would really pretty much limit the death rate. And that's exactly what's happening. It says here, in a world awash in vaccines and treatments and with healthcare providers armed with knowledge gleaned over the course of the pandemic, the latest wave isn't sticking to that old script of hospitals straining under a deluge of seriously ill patients and a distressing number who die. I take issue with that claim about the COVID death counts. There's so much information coming out now about how COVID death counts were absolutely exaggerated, that people often died from other illnesses along with having COVID. But in any case, don't need to relitigate that. There's the LA Times reports, despite wide circulation of the coronavirus, the latest peak is the third highest of the pandemic. The impact on hospitals has been relatively minor. Even with the uptick in transmission, COVID-19 deaths have remained fairly low and stable. And all of this has occurred even with officials largely eschewing new restrictions and mandates. So in other words, David, we have fewer deaths, more COVID cases, more people testing positive, that is, fewer deaths. And despite the fact that most officials are no longer enforcing any kinds of restrictions. So the LA Times reports, like, you know, it's kind of game over, basically. This is what we were waiting for when this thing hit in March of 2020. And yet we've got the government unions fighting to maintain all kinds of restrictions in place. So headline from the Sacramento Bee by good old Wes Ventischer. State worker union gets vocal in fight against CalPERS office requirements. So back to CalPERS. Here's the lead. A union representative who works at CalPERS is leading one of the most visible fights in California state government against strict in-office requirements amid a new COVID-19 surge. Wong Van Nguyen, a district labor council president with SEIU 1000, addressed the retirement systems board of administration at an open meeting last week. That is last week, demanding more flexibility to work remotely amid virus outbreaks. Nguyen told the board, infection rates keep rising. Yeah. So she presented a petition signed by more than 500 CalPERS workers with three demands: a return to full-time telework until the infections drop, a uniform policy for all the department's divisions, and more detailed communications to the union regarding infections. CalPERS currently requires most workers to work from the office 3 days a week under a policy implemented in
March.
Oh
my God, three days?
3 days. So David,
you
knowing
call that modern day slavery in a way.
Well, the stories go on with the SEIU leader claiming that, in fact, this is like a death camp environment. You're forcing us into close proximity and some people won't wear masks because they're not required to. And you're exposing us and we're going to die. But this, again, is just the, what would you call it? The tragic appearance on the stage again of the government unions trying to make a case that we've got to just keep these places closed. And how long before the teachers union picks up?
No, see, I don't think it's tragic. And I'm going to tell you why. I'm being serious. The difference this time, Will, is that the sheep are no longer acting like sheep. It was tragic when this nonsense was going on 2 years ago and 51% or more of the population was buying it or was scared into buying it, was moved by it. It was impacting their behavior. It was declining economic and marketplace activity. The reason it's not tragic now is nobody's following it. No one's listening. They long ago said enough of this nonsense. No one talks about it. There are isolated people out there still wearing a mask. And in some cases, I actually think it may be really respectable. Like they themselves may have a certain severe, you know, health issue. And it's just, they decided to kind of go with that. And I don't have any problem with that at all. But for the days of people just saying like, oh, infections picked up. And why is this person not wearing a mask? I saw some writer at like the New Yorker or Atlantic or one of these say like, I just don't know what to do. I have to travel again. And I just see these barbarians on planes not wearing masks. And I'm being asked to risk my life for these people. And it got like 2 likes on Twitter or something. Like no one cares anymore. Mm. No one's paying attention to them. They're mocking it. And I don't mean people like you and me. I don't mean people on the right. I don't mean Trumpy people. I mean the whole damn world has said enough of your bullshit. I'm sick of this. So I think it's a positive message. It just took way too long.
Yeah.
And we're not editing that out, by the way.
I don't know that I would tell Sarah to edit it out. Hey, David, that's all the time I've got, I think. Anything you want to add before we sign off and get back to our acting sessions?
No, I got Sam Gregg in 25 minutes.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. You can email us with your comments and story suggestions. Please do that. I swear to you, we read these emails. And if I don't personally read them immediately, my assistant Shannon Wooten does. Thank you, Shannon. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. Also, follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend, co-host, and Acton University co-student, co-learner, David Bonson. We give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi. That's the LA-based mariachi metal band for our music. La Revolución continúa la semana próxima. ¶¶